I'm Jamila King in Brooklyn. As you know, in addition to our big Wednesday show at the Mother Jones podcast, every so often you get a bonus episode to spice up your week. These are conversations with interesting people and deep dives into topics we think will serve you in our ever-changing world. This week, lying. Over the course of his presidency, former President Donald Trump delivered over 30,000 false and misleading claims, according to the Washington Post. You might want to forget all about them. Cleanse the timeline, I get it. But our guest today argues that these lies have done lasting damage and they still pose a threat to everything about politics and public life, unless we start understanding the anatomy, the power, and the appeal of lying. Recently, David Korn, our Washington, D.C. bureau chief, caught up with author, professor, government official, and legal scholar, Cass Sunstein. He was recently named senior counselor at the Department of Homeland Security, where he'll oversee the Biden administration's rollback of Donald Trump's policies. But he's not authorized to speak about that just yet. Instead, the longtime Harvard professor and an expert on behavioral economics spoke about his recent book, Liars: Falsehoods and Free Speech in an Age of Deception, where he does a deep dive into how these lies have changed society, our brains, and ways to hold elected officials accountable for, well, just straight up lying. Here's David.
So welcome, Cass.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a basic question, Cass. Why do lies work?
Well, ordinarily, if someone tells us something, like about the weather or about what time it is, we tend to believe it if we don't have special reason to think the statement is false. And in ordinary interaction, most of the time, human society depends on an ability to think that what we hear is true. If not, there'll be too much chaos and confusion from moment to moment. And so culturally, we tend to have a presumption most of the time in favor of a judgment that the other person's telling the truth. Now, in the case of a politician, you might think the person's a politician. I can't believe that person. Or you might think it's a politician who generally is someone who thinks as I do. So I will give them a strong presumption of truth telling, even if I have reason to think that in the particular case, the presumption is not reliable.
So is there an element of tribalism here that we believe people who we want to believe, who we feel are like us?
Data suggests that if someone says something false, even if it's corrected in real time, like immediately, the human mind will tend to credit it in the sense that it will remember it either as true as or as maybe true a lot later. So President Trump's hammering on Secretary Clinton's emails, that was more effective than it ought to have been, because even among many people who know that the hammering was either false or blown into something wild compared to the reality, some part of their mind thought, oh, the emails, there's something bad there. So that's the deepest problem with falsehoods, that they get under our skin and it's hard to get them out. They're a little like a tick. With respect to tribalism, you're completely right that even if there is a bias in favor of believing what we hear is true, even if it's corrected in real time, we will tend to think dismissed if it's from some group we have reason to think not credible. Nazi claims, most people will think, I don't believe that. And of course, Democrats might be willing to dismiss things said by prominent Republicans, and Republicans might be willing to dismiss things said by prominent Democrats. That is part of the problem we face. But the bias in favor of believing things that are false outruns tribalism.
I know that you've done a lot of work with neuroscientists and brain scientists who look at these issues as well. So do we have any understanding about why we as human beings are so susceptible to this?
You phrased it very precisely. Do we have any understanding? And the answer is to that is yes. Do we have a full understanding? Neuroscientists don't yet, but I'll give a clue about what we do understand. Cognitive psychologists find it useful to suggest there are two families of cognitive operations in the human mind. System one might think as a plane is starting to quiver in the sky, we're all going to die. System two thinks, don't worry, planes hardly ever crash. System one, when it hears something provocative or hateful or admiring about another member of the human species, system one will nod. It will think, yes, that person is a criminal, or yes, that person is a hero. System two has to do some work to think maybe that person is a creep and not a hero, or maybe that person is actually a hero and not a creep. System two is often working really hard to counteract system one. And in the case of a political lie, where let's say a president says something that's palpably false, people might think in their deliberative heart, that's a lie. But their system one, their immediate fast thinking might think, yeah, the election was stolen.
Right. So our system two is somewhat held hostage to a certain degree by system one. And that allows scoundrels and scalawags and negative ad manufacturers or lying politicians a certain advantage. These days, once a falsehood or lie is unleashed on social media, it zooms around the world and creates that negative impression that can stick even after correction is put up. And you wrote in your book, negative information in particular puts a kind of stamp in the human mind, and removing is not easy. So is this age-old evolutionary problem or issue even worse now when information is flying about Facebook, Twitter, emails, Instagram, TikTok, Clubhouse, and anything else I may have left out?
In many respects, I think the answer is yes, that things are worse. Under the spell of a deepfake of Tom Cruise, which I saw today, in which he was playing golf and falling down and cackling madly, and it was an extremely convincing deepfake.
What's up, TikTok? You guys cool if I play some sports? Hey, listen up, sports and TikTok fans. If you like what you're seeing, just wait till what's coming next.
To your general point, completely, that on Facebook or Twitter, it is child's play to initiate at least a cascade of false beliefs. And if you are lucky or really clever, you might get a lot of people to believe something. And this is not my imagination. This is, of course, every day of every year, and a lot of people believing something that's entirely untrue.
I have something of a personal interest here, because in 2003, a long time ago, I wrote a book called The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. We now see that he was a piker compared to you-know-who. But a bunch of commentators in the media at the time accused me of being rude and debasing the political discourse was such a ugly accusation that the president was lying. But my point was that it was important for the media to call out lies and falsehoods and to name them. But it wasn't until Trump that they started to say that a lie was a lie. That began late in the 2016 campaign and carried into his presidency. Now, many major news outlets are routinely referring to his baseless election claims as lies. They're using the L word. Does that make a difference?
With respect to lies, I think it's a reasonable inference from what we know from data we have that the vividness and, let's say, firmness of the notion of that it's a lie rather than a mistake or a falsehood has two good features. First, it shows great confidence on the part of the person who's calling out the liar. And second, it's a little like a poison pill by which the person is not being corrected merely, but is also being accused. And if you can deem someone or brand someone, so to speak, systematically unreliable, then that can be an effective way of making their previous statements and their future statements doubtful. The best guess is that to call someone a liar is an effective way of responding to, let's say, a characterological problem with truth telling.
Now, in the book, you quote Cicely Bock, who wrote a book about lying, saying, "A society whose members were unable to distinguish truthful messages from deceptive ones would collapse." And when I read that, I immediately thought of the COVID pandemic. So talk about what happens when you have lying on an issue like a pandemic crisis.
Okay, so if there's a public health crisis that's getting worse and worse, and there are pervasive lies or even just falsehoods, innocent mistakes, then people will die and they won't know what to do. So it's literally fatal. If you're told X and then not X about things that bear on how you're going to manage your day and not die that day, or even how you're going to manage your day and not get fired, then you don't know what to do. And so society depends on a fundamental capacity to believe most of what we hear. Otherwise, workplaces and cities and marriages become, it's just sand.
A reminder, we're talking to Cass Sunstein, a longtime Harvard professor who has just become a top official at the Department of Homeland Security. And he has a new book out. It's called Liars, Falsehoods and Free Speech in an Age of Deception.
Coming up after the break, David and Cass Sunstein talk about the science behind lying. And hey, if you want to support the show, it's really easy. Just go to wherever you're listening to this episode and hit that follow button. Thanks. Mother Jones stories you're hearing right now are brought to you by our listeners and loyal readers who fuel our work. Audience support makes up 2/3 of the Mother Jones budget and helps our team dig deep on stories that matter. Make a donation at motherjones.com/give to keep our nonprofit newsroom humming. Again, that's motherjones.com/give. Welcome back to the show. We're here with David Korn and Cass Sunstein talking about lying, falsehoods, and alternative facts. Let's tune back in.
We know that some lying can be punished, perjury, defamation, false advertising. But in the book, you argue for extending the sort of lying that ought to be punished officially and also in, maybe by the private sector. You write, governments should have the power to regulate certain lies and falsehoods, at least if they can be shown to be genuinely harmful by any objective measure. So what are some examples beyond what I just mentioned? You know, how could they be regulated?
So if people say climate change isn't real, if they say that Bill Russell was not the best basketball player of all time, that should not be punished. People are allowed to say lots of stuff, even if it's demonstrably false. And one reason they're allowed to say things that are demonstrably false is that we can't trust the government to separate truth from falsity in a way that's objective. Another reason is it's really good to hear what our fellow citizens think, even if what they think is false. So I should say I've worked with Facebook on some of these issues, and I'm alert to the difficulty of balancing the need to be politically neutral, the importance of allowing multiple voices to be heard, and the essential need to protect against the platform being used to produce deaths and suffering. So these are hard calls, and that to have an uptick in, let's say, freedom-preserving strategies for reducing the circulation of falsehoods and lies would be a good idea. And when I say freedom-preserving strategies, I mean such things as having a banner at the top saying, for accurate information about COVID-19, go here. And Facebook is doing that now. That doesn't restrict any speech. Or saying something like, in the context of falsehoods, for further information or for alternative perspectives, go here. Or saying, as Facebook sometimes is doing now, false, not taking it down, but branding it as false. So what I love about these approaches is that they suggest more than any time in human history, we have a capacity to choose something that isn't allow or forbid. We have more intermediate approaches that can be helpful, but not censorial. In the context of political processes, something similar should be built on is to build on the freedom-preserving strategies that social media companies are using, and maybe to mandate warnings or disclosure.
I still worry about their algorithms, and I know that in other ways they are contributing to the problem. We and Mother Jones have been hampered by the algorithm, and that was revealed in a bunch of stories that came out a couple months ago. But it seems to be that something we're still all fumbling in the dark a little bit on. You know, in the last couple of months, we have seen, you know, the power of Trump's big lie, and we've also seen the expansion and the some way the solidification of the QAnon conspiracy theory. When you have the former national security advisor to the president of the United States, and it turns out in both, you know, the big lie and the QAnon front, what we're arguing about or dealing with is the complete alternative reality, which is a non-reality. And it's rather dangerous, I think, for democracy if you can't agree on some basics, if you're then going to try to argue over policy. So my question here is, and it's a big one, with something like, you know, Trump's election lies, big lie, the big lie, or the QAnon conspiracy theory, you know, you wrote, when beliefs are motivated, it is hard to dislodge them. Can any of this be dislodged in these instances?
We know with respect to climate change that people who don't believe it's real are more likely to believe it's real if they learn that the solution to the problem is more entrepreneurial activity, more free markets, more inventiveness by the private sector. If they're told that's the right response, then they start to think, oh, I guess climate change is real. If they're told the right response is more regulation and big carbon taxes, they think it isn't real. And I think that's a profound finding, that whether people want to believe facts, as you say, is relevant to whether they do believe facts. And there's certain things that people want to believe. You're talking about, you know, potentially violent in some of the worst cases, where people are, you know, as you say, are friends and neighbors. And there are ways of reaching them that go at what they themselves care about, that can make them reconsider their belief. Now, if they think that the election was stolen or that something terrible is true about some political leader, and let's just stipulate that it isn't true, then there are ways of talking to them that's respectful to them rather than dismissive of them, and that takes on board some things they actually believe that can work.
So once again, our guest has been Cass Sunstein. He's the author of a new book, Liars, Falsehoods and Free Speech in an Age of Deception. So thanks for spending some time with us. Good luck with the book and good luck working for the Department of Homeland Security.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
That's it for this week's special bonus episode. I'm your host, Jamila King. See you soon. This podcast is brought to you by Mother Jones listeners like you who donate to keep our newsroom buzzing. Help us stay on the beat. Go to motherjones.com/give.